a great way to contact us and to get involved is to contact them.
Right. So just go to ColumbiaRiverKeeper.org. And actually, if you look at the projects they have, and there'll be one about coal terminals, and it'll actually take to a link to your organization, I believe.
Great, great.
So
we're hopefully building a website, and, you know, we're busy people. I'm a working person. I work full-time hours. I don't get paid full-time job, but a lot of us are very busy. We don't have time for that, but Columbia River Keeper has really helped us.
And yeah, and we are just about out of time. Anyway,
thank you very much.
Thank you, Roy. We've been talking with Roy Staples, who is one of the leaders fighting the Millennium Bulk Terminals Coal Export Project. And again, for more information, go to ColumbiaRiverKeeper.org and look for the section on coal. So you've been listening to Locus Focus here on Cable Community Radio. And next week, I'm be taking the week off, but we'll be broadcasting a show about beaver featuring writer Francis Backhouse, who's author of Once They Were Hats. I'll be back in 2 weeks, and my guest will be Bob Salinger. We'll be talking about the impending slaughter of cormorants in the name of protecting salmon. My engineer is Kate Welch. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Kathy McToy. Thanks for listening.
And good morning. It is the half a minute past 11 a.m. You are tuned to KBOO Portland. And coming up next, Health Watch is off. We'll hear more on Friday's oil train derailment and fire in the Columbia River Gorge. And at 11:30 on Madness Radio, Irish activist and punk musician Grania Humphreys discusses the campaign for the release of former partner John Hunt, who has been incarcerated and drugged against his will since 2005. And thank you, KBOO members, for your continuing support. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland Saturday Market. From our hands to yours, celebrating 43 years of American arts and crafts, freshly prepared foods with an international flavor, and local music every Saturday and Sunday from March through Christmas Eve in Waterfront Park. Local artisans, international food, live music, PortlandSaturdayMarket.com.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from the Art of Living, presenting Get Happy Portland, a two-day immersive experience of breathing techniques and meditation by global humanitarian Sri Sri Ravi Shankar. Get Happy Portland takes place July 5th and 6th at the Oregon Convention Center. Tickets and information are available at gethappyportland.org. This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland Eye Care, a Southeast Portland optometrist providing eye exams, contact lenses, and medical eye care, as well as eyewear from independent designers. Portland Eye Care is located at 41st and Southeast Division Street in Portland and online at eyepdx.com.
Good afternoon. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Health Watch is off today, so instead we're bringing you a special show today where we're going to talk about what happened on Friday in Mosier, Oregon with the oil train derailment. And I'm joined here, well, first of all, I am Jenny Yokoyama. I'm your host for the next half hour, and I'm joined here today with Nick Caleb. Thank you so much for coming in to KBOO today.
Sure.
Nick, why don't you give us a bit about your background and what you do?
Yeah. So I'm currently the staff attorney at Neighbors for Clean Air. We do mostly air toxics work. But the last 5 years, I've worked a lot on fossil fuel infrastructure opposition in the Northwest with 350 PDX, Center for Sustainable Economy and others. And then I teach at Concordia University in a lot of environmental classes.
So for our listeners who maybe have, I don't know, if you went on vacation and you're just coming back into town right now at 11 o'clock here in Portland, what happened on Friday was that a train carrying Bakken crude oil derailed in the small town of Mosier, Oregon, which is just to the east of Hood River. And it derailed, and multiple cars, I think the reports say it was 14 cars derailed, three or four cars set on fire, and very, very close to an elementary school there in Mosier, Oregon. It made breaking news all weekend. It took them at least more than a half a day to put out the flames. It's still kind of smoldering. The mess is still there. Union Pacific is still cleaning it up. But if you've been paying attention for the last decade or so here in Portland, people have been very, very vocal about the opposition to the crude oil transport, which has just increased in the last 3 years due to Bakken crude. So first of all, can we talk about Bakken crude oil and what makes it so volatile and dangerous?
Among its sort of, even aside from chemical properties of oil igniting when it's put under pressure and exposed to heat, it's what makes it most dangerous in this case is that it's shipped by rail. I mean, this is the factor that makes this process more difficult. And fossil fuels are dangerous no matter how you move them. We've all heard of oil spills. And for folks following like the Keystone XL pipeline construction years back, they know that they're putting in faulty pipeline. And basically this infrastructure is just poorly constructed. So it's not much better to move it by pipe either, but the risks just increase exponentially when you put it on a rail car and start to move it. And a lot of that is just because it's not really been done in the past. This is something that has happened because there's been so much opposition to pipeline projects around the country. And so because they're facing tribal treaty issues, that the oil companies are facing tribal treaty issues and international border issues where they can't move this stuff as freely as they have been able to in the past. And because, you know, something I'd like to talk about a lot, the Asian markets are demanding energy in order to grow. There's just this need to get it to market as fast as possible. And so an already dangerous industry is taking a lot of shortcuts on safety, even in excess of what they've done in the past.
So even with, because they're no longer transporting by truck, so is there more oil now coming through to our ports here in the Pacific Northwest because it's so easy to transport these large amounts by train?
Yeah, and it's because basically the logistics of how this oil has to get to market, it has to be mined and refined in, you know, some point along the route. It has to be put on some kind of transport infrastructure to get to port. So that could be a pipeline, that could be rail. And then it has to get put on a ship and moved across the ocean. And then it can get to the power plants and the market to where it's going to go. And most of this oil is crude oil, fuel quality oil. And then there's a lot of other classes of fossil fuels that are also being shipped in similar dangerous ways. A lot of gas products. Folks will recall a few years ago, we had a propane export terminal that was proposed for the Port of Portland, and gas would be shipped by rail at the same time, also an exceptionally dangerous process. Some of these things, there have been methanol plants proposed in Tacoma, and methanol wouldn't necessarily be used for fuel. It might be used for plastics or something like that, some other chemical derivatives. But nevertheless, they still maintain the dangerous problems, no matter, you know, what form they take, because they're shipped in dangerous ways.
Well, if you were to ask Union Pacific or a lot of these proponents who are pushing for these terminals, they'll tell you that this is a perfectly safe thing. You know, if you transport the train, you know, slow enough. But when you saw the example that happened on Friday, what is very shocking about this derailment here in Mosier was that the train was traveling at the suggested speed. It was at a relatively low speed, and it wasn't going along a curve. All those factors that we tend to think of when it comes to derailment. This idea has very much been pushed that this is safe. This is the safer way to transport oil. And then I think it was on Friday or Saturday, the fire chief of Mosier was quoted as saying, "I hope that this becomes a death knell for this mode of shipping this cargo. I think it's insane." Yet he was actually a proponent. He admitted that he was one of the people who pushed for this idea that it was safe, and now he's saying insane. Why is it that it takes a gigantic explosion, you think, for people to understand how dangerous this is?
I think people understand that it's dangerous, but the way that we operate as a society, especially strange with fossil fuels now as we're trying to transition our world away from the utilization of fossil fuels, is that people still have this kind of like balancing thing in their head where they're like, well, there's an economic impact and then there's safety, and we got to figure out a way to balance this. And especially in some rural communities, this is like, if you're the fire chief and you start speaking out against this, maybe there's political pressure that people could put on you or something like that. So it's hard to say in this individual case, like why this person was either supportive or silent for so long. But, you know, in Vancouver, emergency responders haven't been silent about the Tesoro Savage project. They're saying this is crazy. And
yeah, can you talk a little bit about that, about these departments speaking out against the Tesoro Savage?
Yeah, well, they take a look at what resources they would have in order to battle an oil explosion in the form of either like a train derailment or in the form of like large storage containers being located next to downtown areas. And it doesn't take long for emergency responders and risk analysts to look at this kind of stuff and say the risks are enormous. And they don't have the technology to ensure that people would be safe in the catastrophic situation. And then those risks that already exist are compounded by the fact that we're in a very seismically unstable region. And, you know, folks know that we're due sometime in the next 50 years for a pretty large quake, potentially extremely large and historically large. And storing volatile explosive compounds in liquefaction zones, you know, you can start to see pretty quick why people start to use words like crazy and insane and all the rest to describe it.
It seems really interesting to me. I hadn't really thought about what the emergency response plan would be for a small town like Mosier. I had assumed that by transporting these types of, you know, very hazardous materials through a town, that they would have some type of plan that was probably put in my mind. I thought, oh, well, clearly Union Pacific must have a plan for this. But I was speaking with the mayor of Mosier, and she very much told me that they don't have any sort of action plan. There's no emergency response plan. Is that typical for a town to not have a plan?
Yes, it's very typical. And in some places that have more resources to put together plans, there's still plans where the emergency response and emergency planners are saying, like, we don't have the resources to really do a good job on this. Like, this is the best we could do under the circumstances. These rural communities out in the middle of nowhere, a lot of times they don't have the resources, they don't have the equipment. So they rely on state and federal kind of emergency management, which are also underfunded and also out of the way. And with Mosier, it's, you know, people have been sounding the alarms for many years, ever since they started shipping this amount of oil by rail this often, right? I mean, it's just a matter of time. We've seen derailments and explosions all over North America. We know that our rails are in disrepair. They're not up to standard. We know that this is just an inherently dangerous project. And it's just been, when is this going to happen, is basically what people have said. And we've been assured by the rail companies, we've been assured by the oil companies, we've been assured by all sorts of different entities that this is safe and that don't worry, if something bad goes happen, we'll have it under control. And when I look at the Mosier situation, I think it's a miracle that nobody died. It's a miracle that these rail cars didn't tip over and roll into the Columbia and cause a massive oil spill. I mean, there's so much that could have gone wrong that didn't, that we should take this as the warning sign that it is and really start to make demands on our elected officials and these entities to prove to us that it's safe before you start shipping it.
I guess that's one concern that's been expressed by people, is that because this derailment, you know, it didn't hurt anybody. No, there were no casualties, that clearly the situation was under control. You know, it was allowed to burn out. It was the flames, well, that what you could see, were out by 2:30 in the morning. Do you think that there'll be any sort of that backlash where you say, well, look, this was handled?
We're already starting to see the spin on it a little bit. So Union Pacific, one of the first releases they put out was like, sorry, you know, our bad. And also, don't worry, this is only like 1% of the shipping that we do. And they start throwing out statistics and be like, well, this is just a small thing. But anybody who has the lived experience of walking near the oil lines or driving near the rail lines out in the gorge knows that there are mile-long trains carrying crew coming through all the time. Like, this is big. And, you know, what's also interesting is that the safety reports, that the monitoring that came out of the rails, that the tracks were cleared for safety repeatedly, like you had mentioned earlier, everything that was supposed to go right as far as speed was going, right, everything that was supposed to go right. And they can't explain why this happened. They're having a really hard time figuring out, well, we had this great plan and it still didn't work and it shouldn't have happened. And so those are the experts, you know, telling us not to worry, have no idea why this happened. So, you know, from our perspective, looking at those safety assurances, we might want to look at them a little bit more skeptically than we did before.
And trains are starting to run through Mosier as of, was it yesterday,
yep,
I believe.
With smoldering oil cars next to the tracks. I mean, it's so bizarre. I can't even believe it.
And there's even been report that there's oil leaking and that it's being caught by a tarp. I mean, to me, that seems still like a possibly hazardous, dangerous situation. And, you know, so, I mean, these towns, what happened was Kate Brown, you know, went out recently, and the town, they had asked if Union Pacific could please, well, one, remove all of the derailed cars and move them out of the way. Well, I guess just to actually remove them and to not send trains down the tracks again until all the tanks had been removed. But it was reported that the trains are running again. So I'm just wondering, do these towns have any sort of say or control when it comes to these rail lines running through their towns? Or is it just completely out of their control and that's why they're not able to get these emergency response measures put in place beforehand?
So there are several federal entities that are charged with the rail lines. And one of the reasons why this has been such a problem for activists, organizers, and communities who are trying to pass rules about this is that it's just not, we're not allowed to do it at the local level for the most part. Legally, this is a federal issue. And so, I mean, from my personal standpoint, I think there's more that the state could do in terms of it, demanding safety assurances. And so I'm working with some folks on trying to like make that more popular so that we start putting our state officials on notice that we expect them to do more and to ask for safety assurances and make sure that that happens before they give their blessing to these projects. But it really is just a failure of federal leadership. And the rail lines are federal for historical purposes. And it makes it a really sort of awkward situation here where all along the rail lines, you have people in local communities understanding how dangerous this is. You have emergency responders telling us how dangerous this is, telling us they have no means of doing anything about it. The Mosier fire chief said, you know, if the winds had been at 35 miles an hour, we might have had massive wildfires coming out. I mean, there's so many complicating factors just in the gorge as it is, and it's a scenic area, and it's supposed to be protected for beauty, and there are local businesses, and there's recreation. I mean, there's just so much complexity in that situation. It's mind-boggling that people don't have more control. And so I hope what happens in the next few weeks here is that people start to make demands up the chain. And then we start to find out who exactly does have the authority to make these decisions. And then we start pressing on those people. So it'll be rail safety boards. It'll be potentially the governor. On the one thing that we can do and that local communities do have control over is when this oil is shipped, it has to go somewhere. And a lot of this volume of fossil fuel is ending up at export terminals on the coastline. And we are fighting those projects like crazy. And so if we can stop the new export terminals from going in, then that means that we've at least capped the amount of these trains that can go. And then we can start to talk about even starting to dismantle some of these existing facilities that exist. So it's a really complicated jurisdictional issue. It's a complicated logistical issue, but there are groups that are starting to have figured out how to map this and are taking it on sort of like one piece at a time. Also people fighting at the source of extraction as well.
Well, let's talk about that, about 350.org here in Portland. You can look up them at 350pdx.org to see what campaigns they're working on. Well, let's talk about the campaigns. What are the steps that are being taken to try to stop these ports? What have our local governments done so far that has worked?
So in the fall, 350 and a lot of our community partners were able to get the city of Portland to pass the nation's first fossil fuel infrastructure ban resolution. And so currently we have staff working with the city to write the code in the city to make it so that we're not going to accept these facilities anymore. That in the city of Portland, we're just not going to site an oil export facility and we're not going to site a propane export facility and that sort of stuff. And from a local level, that at least prevents some of that new train traffic from coming in and shipping that in and reduces the risks. We also helped Commissioner Fritz at the city last fall pass a oil train resolution where the city is speaking out. Pretty much any regional fossil fuel terminal project, the city is speaking out in opposition because we know we can't necessarily stop the oil cars from coming through, but we can at least get ourselves involved in those processes to make sure that our voices are in it. So those are some of the projects that 350 is going on. In just a few weeks back, 350 worked with a lot of regional projects to work on a direct action campaign in Anacortes area called Break Free. And so pretty much the sort of framework that 350 PDX is working with is very interested in doing direct action when it's appropriate, very interested in bringing the voices of frontline communities to the forefront when they need to be brought there, and then also involving ourselves in the political process and trying to figure out what are the changes in local government that we can make to make sure that we're keeping our people safe.
When it comes to the Tesoro Savage, what is that about in terms of your campaigns? What are you guys doing in order to, you know, try to prevent this from happening?
Yeah, so we're working with our partners in Vancouver who have been fighting this battle for quite a long time. And I should mention, credit also goes to the Vancouver City Council, who has an oil terminal moratorium that's continually being renewed right there. They're saying this is too dangerous. And I'll take a bit of an aside. I don't know. There was an article that got pushed through recently, and they did a risk analysis for a catastrophic oil explosion in downtown Vancouver. And basically, it said that there would be $6 billion in damage in a worst-case scenario in Vancouver, Washington. And so 350, along with pretty much, you know, like almost every consumer and interest group is opposed to this stuff. There's only the fossil fuel industry and like the port and some banks in Vancouver that are supporting Tesoro Savage. So the community is mobilized. There's a state review process that's going on right now. And so people are looking at Governor Inslee and hoping that he'll veto this project if it continues forward. But basically there's a multi-tiered approach at trying to stop this in any possible way that people can.
Oh, and do you guys feel that it is a working campaign right now? I mean, sometimes it feels like a David and Goliath story, definitely this little town of Mosier right now, that this is the question, can they fight against Union Pacific? Do you feel like your campaigns are having action right now and making a difference?
Absolutely. You know, the fossil fuel infrastructure opposition campaigns in the Northwest, I think, are some of the most exciting action campaigns in the world right now, especially with climate being what it is. And you know, we know that if the fossil fuels that are being extracted from the middle of North America and shipped to Southeast Asia for those markets, if they're all burned, like, we enter apocalyptic climate mode. Like, that's what scientists tell us. And so the Northwest, from Southern Oregon all the way up to Washington and into Vancouver, BC, has banded together in what people are calling a thin green line. And so there are still dozens of fossil fuel infrastructure projects that are being proposed, but we're knocking them off the list almost as fast as they're getting proposed at this point. And so we're seeing a real cultural shift just in a short amount of time, 3 to 4 years, where three or four years ago, we were told these projects are all inevitable. And it seems, you know, now we're on a streak where every couple weeks we see another project that gets knocked down. Most recently, the Lummi tribe was fighting a coal export terminal, and they had the Army Corps of Engineers actually acknowledged that their tribal rights would be interfered with by these projects going in near their tribal lands, and their fishing rights would be impaired. And so they deny projects on that reason. And so we're starting to see like cultural and legal shifts kind of all over the place. And if you're a casual observer, you might not see this as clearly, but for folks that are working in environmental movement and have been working in climate stuff for a long time, that it's a huge groundswell that's happening right now. And it's a very exciting movement to get involved in.
Well, I'm sure the people in these small towns really definitely need the hope. I mean, when I was speaking to, you know, the residents there and the mayor there, there's just such a sense of confusion right now in Mosier, because they don't trust anything that Union Pacific basically would have to say. You know, that back in 2013, they were given the assurance like, oh, we're not transporting, you know, oil through your town. And then they take a picture just a few days later showing, yes, you are. So how is it that these towns, like, what are they supposed to trust? How can they trust the word of these big companies at all?
I mean, like you pointed out, you kind of have to let the record speak for itself.
Yeah.
And when you work in opposition to these big projects for long enough, you see that what these companies tell you up front isn't necessarily the final or most accurate word on what this is. So, you know, that's why a lot of people invest in independent research. And that's why community members will actually go monitor the rail lines and take pictures and figure, because they're not obligated to tell you, basically. And they use that as a reason to obscure it as much as possible, because they don't want community opposition to these projects. So I mentioned before, there's massive jurisdictional issues and everything with local governments, but there's also just a political reality that when people start banding together, even small communities start working with other small communities and down the line, that you can create a force that starts to well up from the bottom up. And sometimes just because something is formally illegal or you're not allowed to do it formally, enough political pressure can change the law. I mean, it's ideally, I mean, that's how it's supposed to work, right? The political pressure changes the rules, changes the law. And so we've seen a lot of that in the fossil fuel fight.
You mentioned like small towns, they need to band together. Do you see any sort of that movement actually happening where they're coming together?
Absolutely. And I'll give you an example. It takes different forms, right? Sometimes it's within communities, like Hood River is a very active community on fossil fuel issues, for example. Sometimes it's commissions that are semi-formal. And so there's a group called the Gorge Commission that's actually a federally constituted commission that's charged with protecting the gorge with the state governments. And 2 years ago, you know, they demanded of Governor Brown and it was Kitzhaber at the time and Inslee, that they put a moratorium on oil trains in order to protect health and safety. And so it didn't go anywhere in that case. They were ignored. But now we look back and we see all of these different community groups and semi-formal and formal organizing efforts that still exist. And those pieces are going to become more coordinated now because now people really see the impetus to do this work. And so, you know, it's a tragedy what happened in Mosier. It's a miracle that nobody was killed. It's awful that there's oil going into our river. But it also, because of the way it happened, allows us now to get serious about this issue and to expand this conversation beyond the places that it was even at before. We can say no to this stuff. There's no reason. I mean, it's an absurd result to say, well, all you can do is just allow potentially explosive oil cars to go by communities in the gorge and endanger health and safety in our beautiful gorge area. I mean, it's just that could be the reality is too absurd. So we shouldn't accept it. We should fight back.
Well, there's so many questions that people have about how do we stop this and or what responsibility does Union Pacific have? Do they have any sort of say as to what they transport? Are they allowed to say, no, we are not going to transport this volatile material?
They say that they don't have, that they would run afoul of laws if they were to discriminate against the commerce that they take. And it's complicated. Like rail law is not my specialty. And what I've looked into in the past is they may have some arguments. There have been lawsuits against them as a carrier, and some of them are still ongoing. And so it's that they may have a legal defense in that way. I'm not entirely sure.
Sounds like a little bit of finger pointing.
I mean, it is. It's what it turns out to be, right? Is, yeah. Well, we're not actually responsible. It's first as well, there's not a problem. It's totally safe. And then, you know.
But it's legal finger pointing in a way where people can say, I am following the law. We have to do this. And then the federal government says, well, we can't, you know. So it really is about people coming to their local governments and asking for change.
Local governments, state governments, federal government. I mean, this stuff has to be movement oriented. And I'm a big proponent of direct action as well. I think when you find yourself in these absurd situations where everyone's pointing the finger at everybody else and saying, well, we can't do this and I'll send you somewhere else. And it's like these, you know, bizarre bureaucracies where you're not exactly intended to run into the result you're looking for. At some point, you just have to say, like, we're going to stand up and do everything we possibly can to not let this stuff happen anymore. And when communities start taking direct action in mass, I think that's when you start to see change come real quick.
We're kind of running out of time here, but just for our listeners, you know, for individuals who want to get involved and maybe they don't have, you know, time to go stand on a rail line and protest, what can people do? Just what are the little action steps that everyday people can do?
Well, I'd say the first thing, there's an event tonight actually at the Unitarian Church at 6:30 p.m. There's a Portland Rising Tide and some of their partners called an emergency oil train sort of like community meeting. So I would say if you're new to this or if you have been following it and you want to get more involved, that's the first place I would direct you. So Unitarian Church in Portland, 6:30 tonight. And then there are just a variety of organizations that are fighting these projects up and down from the point of extraction to when they get on the ships to go overseas. And so I'll just name a few organizations if you like. And so there's Stand Up to Oil, which has been big in the Vancouver fight. There's Rising Tide, which has local chapters up and down the West Coast, 350 PDX, Columbia River Keeper, Friends of the Gorge, Portland Audubon has been a big player in this as well, Center for Sustainable Economy. And then always send notes and letters to your elected representatives. Always, even if it seems like it's pointless sometimes, continue to do it. Make them, it may be a delayed response sometimes until they take the stuff seriously, but it really does make an effort, make a difference over time. They start to hear it and they start to take it on as an issue of importance.
Wow, that half hour just really went by, and I really appreciate you coming in today and talking about this. It's going to be really interesting to see how all of this plays out in the courts and what kind of recourse the town of Mosher gets. So, yeah, oh, well, look at that. It's 11:29. We're all out of time, but I would like to thank you for joining me here live in studio, too. This has been Nate Caleb, and he's working with 350pdx.org. That's 350pdx.org. You can find out more about their campaigns that they're working on right now. And so stay tuned for what's coming up next here on KBOO. It's Madness Radio at 11:30. I'm Jenny Yokoyama. Thank you for listening.
Thank you.
Are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland.
What does it mean to be called crazy in a crazy world? Listen to Madness Radio, Voices and Visions from Outside Mental Health, sponsored by peer-run support communities Freedom Center, the Icarus Project, and Portland Hearing Voices. Madness Radio can be heard on FM stations on the Pacifica Radio Network and is online at kboo.fm/madnessradio. Thanks for joining us today on Madness Radio. I'm your host, Will Hall. Today, my guest is Grainne Humphreys. Grainne is joining us from West Cork, Ireland. She is a psychiatric